Today on Against the Grain, in 1805, a remarkable slave rebellion took place, not in the Atlantic, but in the Pacific, and involving an unusual ruse. And it illustrates, argues historian Greg Grandin, something fundamental about freedom and unfreedom in the New World. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Greg Grandin about a story that was immortalized by Herman Melville. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The modern era, we tend to assume, is the Age of Liberty, launched by the French, American, and Haitian revolutions. Yet the period following those revolutions was characterized by extensive slavery across the New World. Historian Greg Grandin suggests that this is not the contradiction it appears, and that the lack of freedom that characterizes slavery continues with us in various guises since its abolition. It's through a historic event, a slave rebellion in the Pacific Ocean that was ultimately repressed by an anti-slavery Republican, that Grandin explores the nature of freedom and bondage in his latest work, The Empire of Necessity, published by Metropolitan Books. He's also the author of Empire's Workshop and Fordlandia, and he teaches at New York University. I have the pleasure to be joined by Greg in studio. I wonder if you could begin by telling us about this incident. It was written about in a novella by Herman Melville, and you use it to tell a much broader story about slavery and the modern condition.
Well, the story that opens the book is about this remarkable slave ship uprising that takes place, actually not in the Atlantic, where we associate slavery and chattel slavery and the triangle slave trade, but in the Pacific, in the South Pacific, off the coast of Chile. It was a group of West Africans that had been brought into Montevideo, sister city to Buenos Aires, marched across the Pampas, Argentina, and then over the Andes and into the Pacific, and they were put back on another ship on the way to Lima to be sold in the slave market there. And about a week out of port, they rose up and seized the ship. And they killed most of the Spaniards, including the slaver that was taking them to Lima, and they demanded to be returned to West Africa. Now, that in itself is interesting, but not particularly remarkable. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of slave ship uprisings, the most famous one in the United States, at least, being the Amistad. But what's interesting is what happened next. And what happened next is after about 50 days of sailing up and down the Chilean coast, because the Spanish captain, Benito Cedeño, didn't want to cross into the Atlantic, didn't want to make that treacherous turn around Cape Horn, and so was stalling. They came upon another ship. This ship was called the Perseverance, and it was captained by a New Englander named Amasa Delano. Now, the West Africans had two choices. They could have fought or they could have fled. Instead, though, they came up with this remarkable plan. They let the New England captain, who they didn't know the name, obviously, but it was Amasa Delano, board the ship, and they would pretend to be slaves. They would act as if they were still enslaved. And they managed to pull off this remarkable deception for over 9 hours. And it just a remarkable, not just because they were successful, but because they did it under enormous hardship. They were starving. They were thirsty. They had run out of food and water. Two women had died of thirst, and two children had died of thirst. And yet, they somehow managed to stage this deception and this ruse that for 9 hours fooled a very experienced captain, New England captain.
So they pretended that they were still the enslaved servants on the ship, and they coerced the captured captain to play along.
Yes. And so the main kind of axis and tension was Amasa Delano trying to figure out what the relationship was between Benito Cedeño, the Spanish captain, the man who introduced himself as captain, and the person who was introduced as his personal slave, Maury. And every time that Amasa Delano wanted to speak to the Spanish captain alone, the Spanish captain would beg off and say, no, anything you need to say to me, you could say in front of Maury, my personal slave. And of course, it was because he was living under the threat of death, that if, you know, Maury was pretending to be his personal servant in order to keep watch and listen to the conversation.
But Delano had some sense that something was a little strange about this, right?
Yeah, he had a sense that there was something wrong. He knew that there was something not quite right about this ship. At first, he thought that Benito Sereno, who was shattered from his experience, remember, this was 50 days into being held captive by this group of West African rebels. He thought that Benito Sereno was maybe plotting to take his ship, that maybe he was a pirate. And he was in league with the West Africans, and they were going to take his ship. But he went back and forth from being anxious and worried. And he was also anxious that maybe Benito Sereno, representing old world Spain, thought himself too good. He also felt insecure in the face of Benito Sereno. So it's interesting into the psychology of this New Englander. But then he grew increasingly obsessed with the relationship between Benito Sereno and Maury, the person who was introduced as a slave but was really this rebel turned actor. So it was just this interesting portrait of this psychological portrait of this New England captain.
And then how did the story end? In actuality.
So this went on for about 9 hours, and events conspired that Amasa Delano was left alone. He sent his men to a nearby island in order to fill up the water casks. He was told that the ship had run into a storm and then had got caught in the doldrums, and that's why there's no Spaniards on board, that they all either fell overboard during the storm or they were, died from fever. He was on board by himself for a good part of the day, for 9 hours, and then he was leaving. He went to leave the ship. The ruse actually worked up until the very end. He had climbed down the ladder into his boat with his away team, and they were making ready to row back to his ship. And it's at that point that Maury, who managed to pull off this deception, must have felt an enormous rush of pride that he was able to do this. And he asked Benito Sereno, how many men does Amasa Delano have on board his ship? And when Benito Sereno said, well, 20, but most of them were on the island, and Maury said, well, good, because we'll easily take the ship tonight and we'll use that to return to West Africa. It's at that moment that Benito Sereno realized that his situation wasn't going to improve anytime soon. So he pitches himself overboard and he comes crashing down in Amasa Delano's boat. And it's at that moment that Amasa Delano realizes that he's been the victim of this elaborately staged deception, and he rallies his men to put down the rebellion and re-enslave the West Africans.
So one of the interesting aspects to this story is this character, this person, in fact, Amasa Delano, because he is someone who has ideas that are in some way contrary to the dominance of slavery at the time, right? This is someone who's a Unitarian. So tell us about his ideas and how they did or didn't influence what he then did at this point, which you mentioned, of putting down this rebellion.
So the story itself, the book itself, tells basically two storylines. One of them is the West Africans out of West Africa, across the Atlantic, into the Americas, and into the Pacific. The other one tracks Amasa Delano out of New England and as a kind of avatar of the promise of the American Revolution. He was born in Duxbury, Massachusetts, which was a town that early on gave up the kind of Calvinist gloom that, one's destiny was predetermined and one's fate and where one would wind up was already decided, and embraced a much more optimistic, even radical Christianity, the idea that the world, that human beings were perfectible, that they can govern themselves, and if they can govern themselves, they can govern each other politically, as this was the foundation of what was most radical of the American Revolution, the radical republicanism of the 19th century. And Amasa Delano really was of this type. He was from a region in which slavery, he was opposed to slavery, but he didn't think it was much of a problem because this was the early 1800s, and many people thought that slavery, even if they were morally opposed to it, thought it was withering away, not just in the North, where it was in fact withering away in the North, but that even in the South, that it was a problem that was a problem of the past. And what's fascinating about it is that Amasa Delano basically sails into America's future in the Pacific, this world of race, violence, and terror, and repression, and what he finds there is what would later grip the United States, you know, after the explosion of chattel slavery in the 1810s and 1820s and 1830s.
And so for him, and as you say, you sort of see him as representing something much more than just the views of an individual, but how did he reconcile, did he try to reconcile his own views on slavery and the actions that he took, which was to re-enslave these West Africans who had freed themselves?
Right. The way that I think about it is, again, thinking about these two different storylines, and one being the history of the West Africans, and one being the history of Amasa Delano. Amasa Delano really, really is a failure at most everything he does. He is he's thrust into the world by the American Revolution. The American Revolution is this world historical event that happens when he's a teenager, and he goes out in the world to make good in the world. And he's largely a failure at everything he does. He cannot redeem the promise of the American Revolution. He's a little bit of a Republican zealot. He finds himself witnessing or many of the storied events of the creation of the modern world. He's in India when at the beginning of British colonialism. He's in South Africa, witnessing the roots of Dutch, what eventually becomes apartheid. He's in the Galapagos Island before Darwin. But he's largely a failure in terms of economics. He can't quite get it together, except as a sealer, and that's what he's doing in the South Pacific. He's sealing.
Seal hunting,
yes. And seal hunting is this fascinating industry, and it's really the United States' first experience with boom and bust resource extraction. I mean, we think of whaling, but whaling was a much more sustainable. We don't think of it as sustainable, but it took place over the course of decades before it really exhausted many of the whale herds. But sealing took place. The boom was in the 1790s. New Englanders like Amasa Delano found themselves in the South Pacific, and they were hunting seals. There were tens of thousands, millions of seals in rookery after rookery, island after island, beach after beach. It seemed kind of endless. And they would take seals out. They would kill the seals and bring them to Canton in China. And what began to happen, though, was there were so many seal skins being brought into China that the prices began to collapse. And within a remarkably short period of time, what you had was collapsing prices and extinction, because the only way that these sealers could make up the difference of the margins was to accelerate the killing. So Amasa Delano was there for the boom, and his very first sealing expedition in the 1790s, he did quite well. And his second expedition, though, was during the bust, and there was no seals left to kill and no money to be made. So his own crew is on the verge of mutiny. They're conspiring. They're complaining. He's resorting more and more to physical punishment in order to maintain authority. And so part of the putting down of the slave rebellion allowed him to reestablish authority over his own crew. And this is where these two storylines, the violence of slavery and the violence of an ecological destruction as represented by sealing, intersect and come together. And he doesn't actually ever reconcile it. He becomes, I think, quite shattered by what happens. He goes back to the United States, and he winds up his life poor and destitute, but also very jaundiced and cynical about Christianity, about the American project, and about American expansion.
And how do we know what we know about the story? As you say, you sort of trace it along a number of lines, and I want to ask you about that other thread, which is the journey of the West Africans. But Herman Melville wrote his book about half a century after this event took place. The information that we do know about what took place and how people viewed it and sort of the unfolding of events, where does that come from?
Well, it mostly comes from Amasa Delano's memoir, which he wrote as a way to get out of debt, and he published it about a little bit over 10 years after the event itself. And Melville get, and that's where Melville gets the story from. Melville writes this, he fictionalizes the event in this remarkable short story, that he, or novella that he publishes in 1855. And he gets it all from Amasa Delano's memoir, which recounts his seagoing life. But and that's published in 1816. And then Melville reads it and fictionalizes it 40 years later.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with historian Greg Grandin about his new book, The Empire of Necessity, that's published by Metropolitan Books. So then there is, of course, another thread to the stories that you mentioned, and that's the trajectory of the West Africans who found themselves ultimately aboard this boat and mutinied. I wonder if you can tell us what you know about the course that they took and how they experienced it.
Well, the West Africans came into the Americas in early 1804, and this was the height of what the Spaniards were calling free trade in slaves, free trade in blacks. And for centuries, slavery existed in the Americas since the 1500s, when the Spaniards and Portuguese set up the institution we think of as chattel slavery. But for a long time, it was tightly controlled under a system that the Spaniards called mercantilism. It was highly regulated. Only a small number of Spanish American merchants could participate in the trade. Only a small number of American port cities were allowed to import slaves, Havana, Cartagena, and whatnot. And only a small number of companies had the license, monopoly license, companies and countries to import slaves into the Americas. That begins to change in the 1770s. The Spanish crown begins to use words we would associate with today's economy, they began to deregulate the slave trade. They began to privatize the slave trade and lower tariffs and lower taxes and grant more and more people the right to engage in slavery directly, every man a slaver in some ways. I mean, Spanish-American merchants had long been demanding more free trade, more liberty to engage in economic activity, including the right to buy and sell Africans themselves, unmediated through the crown. And in response to the American Revolution, to the French Revolution, to the Haitian Revolution, Spain gradually gave in to these demands. And 1804 was a, by 1804, when the West Africans came into Montevideo, it was a free-for-all. More slaves came in to Montevideo, which was granted the right to import slaves under this regime of deregulation, than any year previously. This group of West Africans, or at least a portion of this group of West Africans that wind up in the Pacific, actually were headed towards the Caribbean. They were on a Liverpool slave ship, and they were intercepted by a French Jacobin pirate, privateer, who had contractual relations with merchants in Montevideo and Buenos Aires. You know, sometimes when we think of pirates, we think of them almost as proto-anarchists, sailing the ever-free sea, enthralled to no man or no nation or no law. But in the case of Spanish America, they were vanguard merchant capitalists. They worked very directly, hand in glove with Spanish American merchants, to seize British goods, because France and Britain were at war with each other, and divert those goods into Spanish America. And by far the most valuable good was slaves, were human beings. And these West Africans came in on this French pirate ship, this French revolutionary pirate ship, and very quickly they were transformed from contraband into commodities. They got caught up in machinations in Montevideo and Buenos Aires, which I go into detail in the book. Some of them were involved in at least two other slave ship rebellions before they were gathered together into this one lot in Montevideo and then in Buenos Aires and then shipped across the Pampas. As part of this explosion of slavery that happens in the Americas, more and more slaves were being shipped overland. I mean, there was two ways of getting to Lima. One, you can go around Cape Horn by ship. But that was expensive, and only some of the well-placed and wealthy merchants could afford that route of transportation. Or you can ship them overland, over the Pampas, and then over the Andes, and then back down into the Pacific, and that was cheaper. So some of these smaller-scale slavers that were just getting into the game with the deregulation of slavery preferred that route. So more and more in the early 1800s, you saw large caravans of slaves heading out of Buenos Aires and across the Pampas, and it's just a remarkable journey when you think about it. Because when we think about slavery, we think of the Atlantic Triangle trade, sure. We think of the Middle Passage, which was horrible and brutal in all sorts of ways, which are high mortality. But this group of West Africans had something of a second Middle Passage. The trip across the Pampas overland took as long as it took to get across the Atlantic. So this was added to the hardship. Not only were they brought in across the Atlantic, they were shipped across the American continent. And then they approached the Andes. The Andes are the second highest mountain range in the world, but what makes them very impressive and imposing is that they're the narrowest. So the Himalayas, for instance, which are the highest mountain range in the world, tend to rise gradually. So in some ways, the highest points of the Himalayas aren't that impressive, as it takes, by the time you get in sight, you're already fairly high up. The Andes is like approaching some great wall, and particularly from the side of the Pampas, which is preternaturally flat. So you could just imagine what the experience was like for these West Africans across the Pampas and as they approach the Andes. Now, what's even more interesting is that many of the West Africans were Muslim. They were from West Africa, where Islam had migrated down centuries early. And as they approached the Andes was also the beginning of Ramadan. These West Africans track their movement across nearly a third of the globe by following the lunar calendar, Ramadan.
And how do we know this about the route and things that were encountered by this particular group of West Africans?
Well, we don't. I mean, there's most of the documentation are sales receipts and legal documents, and there's nothing that captures the experience themselves of the subjectivity or the agency or what they experienced as human beings. There is one historical fact that they themselves produced, and that is that they staged their uprising on the ship once they were put back on the ship in the Pacific and a week out of port on the holiest day of Ramadan, the night of power. That's the night that Muslims celebrate as and then the holiest day of Ramadan, the holiest day in Islamic calendar. That's the day that Muslims celebrate when the Archangel Gabriel presented the first verses of the Quran to Muhammad. It's celebrated by Muslims the world over. And the fact that they managed to time and stage their revolt on the eve of the night of power is quite remarkable when you think about it. One, it shows that you know this. Their ordeal started over a year earlier, and so they managed to track their movements by keeping watch of the moon, the phases of the moon. Islam holds a lunar calendar, and that they were accurate to the day. And that also meant that when they started their ascent up the Andes, was the first day of Ramadan. So not just the holiest day of Ramadan, but all of Ramadan, a month that holds a very special place in the Islamic calendar, was probably their most extreme ordeal. They were driven up not just the highest mountain range, second highest mountain range in the world, the highest in the Americas, but at the highest point of the Andes, in the shadow of the highest mountain in the Americas. And one could just imagine the kind of metaphorical meaning of Ramadan, right, approaching the Godhead, kind of collapsed into the literal material experience of ascending into this extreme environment.
Do you have any sense that this particular group of West African slaves was exceptional? Obviously, the tale, which is at the absolute center of your book, Greg Grand and the Empire of Necessity, is a really remarkable story. But you also say that a number of these slaves had been involved in other rebellions as well. Was that atypical? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, historians have documented about 600 slave ship rebellions, revolts, over the course of the 100 years. But that's really just a faction. Those are just the ones that were recorded, because most slave ship rebellions, revolts, were put down and not reported. So there's no documentary evidence. These West Africans, some of them were involved in two other revolts outside of Montevideo and Buenos Aires, and which I talk about in the book. But those didn't make it into those aren't counted in the 600. So one can, I mean, for just extrapolating from that, one can assume that there were thousands and thousands of revolts. I think enslaved Africans did what they could to achieve their freedom and any opportunity they had, particularly during these extreme moments of hardship, which were, of the transport, of being moved from one place to another.
Well, let me ask you then about Herman Melville's novella, Benito Sereno, which was written almost half a century after this rebellion takes place. How did Melville come at the sort of central aspects of the story? What was included from the historical record? What was left out intentionally? And what was the sentiment that drove his storytelling?
Yeah. So Melville writes Benito Sereno in 1855, and it's a very consequential moment in both his own his life and then in the life of the nation. It's a few years after the failure, the commercial and critical failure of Moby Dick. I mean, now we think of Moby Dick as the American novel, but at the time, critics thought it was an indication either of Melville's irrelevance or his insanity, and it didn't sell. And he was greatly disappointed, and it was one of the precipitating factors in his emotional breakdown. And Benito Sereno was a few years after that, and a few years before the coming of the Civil War. So a very fraught moment. Soon after he finished it, Melville broke down physically and emotionally. There's not a lot of information about what it was that motivated Melville to write this story. He was opposed to slavery, but he also was too fearful that the fight against slavery would destroy the American Republic. So he felt that he was at an impasse. He thought that America faced one of two choices: to either fight slavery and slavery, which might destroy the Republic, either through a civil war, a revolution, or a secession, or leave slavery in place and admit that freedom for some required the enslavement of others. And I think there's something about the bleakness of Benito Sereno that captures that impasse. I mean, the best way to think about Benito Sereno is to compare it to Moby Dick. Moby Dick is, obviously it ends in catastrophe, right? The Pequod goes down and there's only one survivor. But as you're reading that story, there's a lot of joyous moments. There's a lot of joyful moments. There's a lot of humor in the book. It's a very wide open book. It takes place on multiple oceans. There's men of all races coming together, and Melville captures some of the beauty of their interaction and the way they synchronize their movements and their laughter. And it's really just this wonderful book. Benito Sereno is almost the exact opposite in both form and tone. It takes place all on board one ship, one day, but even more than that, it really takes place in the mind of Amasa Delano. Melville tells the story all through Amasa Delano's point of view. Readers don't know the West Africans are in charge until Melville reveals them to be in charge about two-thirds into the story. It's this wonderful, wonderful experiment in capturing the mental processes of the master class, not the slave owning master class, but this kind of New England, forward looking modern man who believed himself to be part of this new world borning, this world that this new republican world of freedom and light that New Englanders thought they represented. And Melville, really captures the blindness of that by exploring the thought processes of Amasa Delano. And it's an incredibly claustrophobic story, and it's an incredibly bleak story in which it just ends in complete and absolute disaster. And I think it indexes his own his own emotional state and his own political pessimism.
Well, in fact, you write in The Empire of Necessity that for Melville, Ahab and Delano both represent two sides of U.S. expansionism. What do you mean by that?
Well, this goes back to a question that you asked earlier about how Amasa Delano, the real Amasa Delano, could justify his actions in putting down the slave rebellion and then trying to get half the value of the surviving slaves. You know, Ahab is often held up as an icon, as a symbol of unhinged American power. And this is a long tradition. It goes back a while. Oliver Stone in Platoon has this great line where one of the homicidal sergeants who massacres a Vietnamese village, you know, some other character says he's our Ahab. Edward Said famously called George Bush Ahab, you know, equated George Bush's quixotic and obsessive hunt for Saddam Hussein as, you know, Ahab, Melvillian and its Ahab obsessions, monomania. But, you know, Ahab in many ways is not a good symbol of American power because he's a rebel. His pursuit of the white whale is against all economic interests. It's, you know, there's a famous scene in Moby Dick where Starbuck reminds Ahab that, well, maybe we shouldn't be hunting this white whale because it's going to hurt the profit margins of the owners of the Pequot, you know, back in Nantucket. And Ahab says, owners, what cares Ahab? Let them stand on a Nantucket beach and howl into the wind. You know, it's this, he's a rebel against convention. He's a rebel. I mean, he's obviously destructive to the people around him, but he's not, I think, indicative of the real kind of motive force of American expansion. What's more compelling, I think, about Amasa Delano, both the fictional Amasa Delano as Melville represents him and the historical one, is that he's not a rebel. He represents a much more complex and in some ways more fraught aspect of American power, the need to maintain labor discipline in a moment of ecological scarcity, in this kind of, you know, during this moment of boom and bust resource extraction capitalism, and he's a much more kind of commonplace symbol of U.S. power, the resource extractor, and the violence that he unleashes in putting down the rebellion is much more driven by the laws of supply and demand, by the need to maintain labor discipline and labor hierarchy during this moment in which ecological scarcity is undermining the ability to maintain that hierarchy and discipline. I think it's a much more damning portrait. I think Amasa Delano is a more typical face of U.S. power than the rebel Ahab.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by historian Greg Grandin. He is here to talk about his book, The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. That's published by Metropolitan Books. He's also the author of Fordlandia, an Empire's Workshop. So, and we have been discussing this remarkable story of slavery and rebellion, which raises all sorts of questions about the meaning of liberty. And I guess I'd like to ask you about the contradiction at the heart of this book, which is that the time in which this story takes place is in many ways the much vaunted age of liberty, right? The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, and yet at the same time it's the age of slavery. And in many ways, in sort of commonplace histories, those things are seen as at odds. If they exist at the same time, it's out of contradictory impulses, or perhaps one is a remnant of the past, the other is the historical progress taking over, and at some point, hopefully, one vanquishes the other. You're making an argument that these things are actually deeply embedded within each other. Rather than being polar opposites, freedom, unfreedom here are tightly bound up together. How is that? And perhaps you could tell us what you mean by freedom, liberty, and unfreedom.
Well, as you mentioned, the story does take place during the Age of Revolution. 1804, 1805 is the year that Haiti declares its independence. So it's pegged right towards the Haitian Revolution, which is in some ways takes place in the center of the Age of Liberty, a generation after the American Revolution, a generation before the Spanish-American Revolution. When we think of, there's all sorts of ways in which slavery creates the condition for liberty, and just material, in terms of material wealth, the distribution and generation of prosperity, which allows more and more people to cultivate the higher notion of autonomy and independence and one of individual preference. There was an historian, Edmund Morgan, in the 1970s, who wrote this wonderful book called American Freedom and American Slavery, in which he looked at colonial Virginia, and he made the argument, he used the phrase, the paradox of slavery and freedom. And what he meant by that is the ways in which freedom didn't just exist at the same time as slavery, but depended on the expansion of slavery, depended on the wealth of slavery, depended on the prosperity generated by slavery in very real ways, in the sense that the colonists used profits that were generated by slavery to buy the guns in which they could fight European powers. What I tried to do in this book is step back and think about that paradox on a hemisphere-wide scale. I mentioned earlier that the Spaniards, starting in the 1770s, begin to deregulate the slave trade, and a lot of that was in response to these revolution, the revolutionary period. The Spanish crown wanted to maintain the loyalty of Spanish merchants. So, with the American Revolution, with the French Revolution, with the Haitian Revolution, they began this process of deregulation and expanding slavery. That in turn kicks off this market revolution, this Atlantic market revolution, which is the foundation in many ways of the modern world. It seems a little bit abstract to say that the age of slavery and the age of freedom were one and the same thing. But just think of these numbers and statistics. So historians estimate that there were about 12.5 million Africans taken out of the continent and brought to the Americas in chains. Of that 12.5 million, they have documentary evidence of about 10 million, a little bit over 10 million, ship manifests and whatnot, information on embarkation and disembarkation and so on. Of that 10 million, which took place from the 1500s up until when Brazil ended slavery, the last country in the Americas to end slavery in the 1880s, more than half, more than 5 million, came after July 4th, 1776. So in very real ways, just those statistics show that the way the Age of Liberty was also the age of slavery.
Of course, freedom can be understood in different ways, but one of them can be around freedom to trade through the market. So when the global market was created in the period following these revolutions, how central did slavery remain to these developing capitalist economies in Europe and in North America?
Well, I think it was absolutely central to the development of capitalism. And this is an insight that historians have known, for decades. But it's knowledge that seems to be lost with every generation. In 1944, Eric Williams wrote this wonderful book, Capitalism and Slavery, that looked at the way that the slave trade, the Caribbean slave trade, generated the wealth, and secondary industries like shipbuilding generated the wealth that fueled industrialization in England. More recently, there's been historians like Walter Johnson at Harvard and Sven Beckett and others that have looked at the ways in which slavery contributed to the industrialization and financialization of the North. Didn't just create, didn't just generate the capital that funded industrialization in the North, but created financial wealth. Many banks and insurance companies from the North got their start underwriting slave enterprises or writing policies on slave lives or slave ships. There's ways in which in Spanish America, slavery was absolutely central to what we think of as the market revolution, creating the wealth, tying hinterlands together, the transport of slaves from one region to another, you know, opened up new markets and created new circuits of capital and credit. In Spanish America in particular, slaves were much more diverse. You know, we think of, when we think of slavery in the United States, we tend to think of the explosion of slavery that happens after the 1810s and 1820s with the invention of the cotton gin and the increasing demand for cotton and sugar and the push into the Mississippi and into eastern Texas and opening up of Louisiana and things like that. But in Spanish America, slavery and in North America, very much associated with large plantations and plantation export economies, whether it be cotton or sugar. In Spanish America and in Brazil, slaves were much more diversified into every aspect of the economy. In Buenos Aires and Montevideo, the typical slave enterprise tended to be one or two or three or four people working in workshops, not in large plantations, bakers and artisans and bricklayers, part of the new urban service economy. They operated more on a spectrum. Many slaves were actually paid wages in Spanish America, so they were also consumers. Slaves, and you know, they were capital, they were credit. Slavers could rent out their slaves to others, and which slaves earned a wage, and they had to kick up part of their wage to their owners. It was a much more diversified labor system in Spanish America. I mean, there were plantations, there were sugar plantations, and large scale mining operations, but it was much more kind of integrated into everyday economics. And it was much more, as you know, slavery was an economic system, but it was also a psychic and emotional one as well. And slaves were status symbols. They were, for a rising gentry and merchant class, the number of slaves you own was a symbol of your success. You know, merchant women couldn't go to mass on Sunday without trailing a long procession of slave servants, well-dressed slave servants behind them to tend to them. For a declining aristocracy, the liberalization of the slave trade was part of the liberalization of the larger market that was eroding their position and allowing, more and more new wealth to rise up.
Sure, you actually have a interesting story about the rather reactionary Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges and his citing his grandmother's involvement in buying slaves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I use that as a way to talk a little bit about this, the emotional attachment that many could have towards slavery and the nostalgia. So, for a declining aristocracy, they might see slaves as the last kind of solid object, and they latched onto them like cattle and livestock. And the slaver that was actually responsible for bringing these West Africans into the Pacific was from a provincial town, Mendoza, and he was part of a declining aristocracy that got into the slave trade as a way of kind of shoring up his position in this fast-changing economy. But he couldn't afford to bring them by ship around Cape Horn, so he transported them himself across the Pampas and over the Andes, and then he was killed during the uprising.
Well, that diversity of form that you're just describing, that slavery didn't just follow the template that we may picture of slavery in the U.S. South, that you would find these sort of hybrid forms, such as slaves who actually were wage earners and still enslaved, then brings me to the question about other forms of sort of bonded work that wasn't officially slavery. What else was happening for those people who were not caught up in slavery but still were part of the labor force? To what degree did you find forms of labor that were coerced or bonded in some way?
Yeah, so the book in some ways is an ethnography of the experience of freedom and slavery, right? And even though in the United States, those two ideals, freedom and slavery, were increasingly defined as antagonistic and opposite, right? Freedom was understood to be the opposite of slavery. The reality was that most people, if not all people, lived somewhere in between those two poles. And in the book, where I look at that the most was the experience of sealers, the sealing crew, the sealers that were left on these islands, that were left to seal, the debts that they incurred, the ways that they tried to fight the debt and break out of the debt, the ways that the ways that they were bonded on these ships. One of the things that's interesting is that the ship itself, the Trial, the Spanish slave ship, was actually seized by Spaniards from this Quaker sealer slash smuggler, and on board that ship was an array of different forms of labor, including indentures and African American and American Indian children who was sold into indentureship and served as cabin boys and whatnot on ships. So there was this way. So what I tried to do in the book is show the lived experience of what it was like to live between these two extreme poles of freedom and slavery.
My name is Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, historian. He teaches at NYU, and he is the author of The Empire of Necessity, which we're discussing today. So how central, then, when you talk about the ubiquity of some kind of coercive labor in these societies across the board, how did race play such a central role, though? Because, of course, you know, there would be white people who would find themselves as indentured servants. But clearly, there's also something that was very particular about generating notions of difference and inferiority. How did that play out in a society where unfreedom didn't just follow simple racial lines?
Well, I think it hardens. I think that's one of the things that is so compelling about Amasa Delano, both the real one and Melville's rendition, is that I think he signals to a new kind of racism, right? A new kind of racism that's born in chattel slavery, but outlives chattel slavery. It's a racism that isn't justified in terms of theology or justified in terms of philosophy, but more on the psychic need to define one's freedom in relationship to another's absolute slavishness. And that's what's so compelling, ultimately, I think, about to come back to the deception and what it is that's so shocking and why Amasa Delano is not able to see what's in front of his eyes, is that these West Africans, they were exposing, I think, the fundamental deceit on which slavery as an institution was founded on, the idea that slaves had no independent interior lives, that they had no discipline, that they had no resources, that they had no cunning, that they couldn't use that cunning to manipulate reality. And here was a group of West Africans that were doing exactly that. They were using the things they were said not to have, not to possess, reason and cunning and discipline, in order to give the lie to the things that they were said to be humble and simple-minded and loyal and faithful. And I think that this set piece that opens up the book captures that tension. And Amasa Delano, who understands himself as free in all senses of the word, he believes himself to be a man who possesses reason, a man who can use his reason and his will and his resources in order to control his appetites and his passions and his emotions. And he's confronted with a group of people in which he measures that ability against, you know, because he measures his freedom against the West Africans' slavishness, and they reveal that to not be the case, that he was the one that was actually trapped and enslaved by his own prejudices, his own biases, and his own emotions, his own weird yearnings that he had about Benito Cedeño and Maury the slave. And it's the West Africans who were actually able to summon up the remarkable willpower in under conditions of enormous hardship in order to play their role. And I think that deception really gets at the heart of the fundamental deception that is slavery, but then also the way that deception metastasizes throughout society as market relations, as capitalist relations spread, and as there is more of a kind of a gap and wedge driven between substance and appearance that capitalism drives forward. And what I try to do in the book is look at the centrality of race to that, the way slavery was implicated in all sorts of complicated ways, and why race outlives slavery, right? Why this kind of, you know, this new racism that Amasa Delano, I think, captures and embodies outlives it, and the ways in which this, you know, particularly in the United States, what is a cult of individual supremacy and is manifest in all sorts of policies and politics and political reactions in the United States really has its roots in white supremacy, and why, you know, the contemporary politics can't escape the language of race and the rhetoric of race and the symbology of race and the Civil War. You know, I don't know whether, you know, the Tea Party and the radical right are racist in a simple way. You know, some of them are and some of them aren't, I'm sure. But the language in which that they use to understand contemporary politics is deeply rooted in a history of racism and slavery during this moment.
One of the things that you point to about the way that these questions of freedom and freedom how, I guess, is part of it, and the centrality of the market in defining what's free, is the way that society has shifted since that time, and that some things have become less visible that might have been out in the open before. You write about sort of invisible traps. So I wonder if you could speak about that, the way that clearly people are still bound up in very complex, exploitative relations through the market, but there's nothing as overt as slavery. Very few people, I mean, one can find some exceptions, but really very few people find themselves in any kind of formal position of slavery in this society. So what was lost in having what was so very horrifically visible evolve and change or disappear, but other things taking its place?
Yeah, well, this is an argument that David Brian Davis, the great historian of slavery, makes, is that slavery had the benefit of condensing an extremely brutal form, these relations of exploitation that have existed and still exist in different ways. And the fight against slavery was a process of reification and abstraction, in which slavery itself was seen as the only and an isolated evil, and you do away with that formally, and then it tends to obscure the way that slavery continues in other forms. And I'm not just talking about, you know, wage slavery. I'm talking about the way that slaves, you know, emancipated Africans were re-enslaved through debt bondage and peonage and slavery by other dames and, you know, things like that. But also the ways in which, on a more generalized, it contributes to this cult of individualism. And this, I think, is ultimately what Herman Melville gets at, that he was a very strong critic of the extreme individualism that was taking hold. You know, I think he believed that people existed somewhere between the two poles of freedom and slavery that were structuring the political rhetoric of antebellum America. And he has a lot throughout his writings. He talks about how we're all born in whale lines. We all come into the world with halters on our neck. We're all fast fish. We're all loose fish. Meaning that we're nobody's completely free. Who ain't a slave? I think he believed that this rhetoric of absolute freedom blinded people to the dependency that they had on one another, it's a kind of moral standpoint that I take in the book and use as the book's ending.
Rick Grandin, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the author of The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. That's published by Metropolitan Books. Rick Grandin is also the author of Fordlandia and Empire's Workshop, and he teaches history at NYU. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha, Lily, and CF Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.